Nomine Patris, Filii, Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Ave Maria, gratia plena, Dominus tecum. Benedicta tu in mulieribus, et benedictus fructus ventris tui, Iesus.
Sancta Maria, Mater Dei, ora pro nobis peccatoribus, nunc et in hora mortis nostre. Amen.
Nomine Patris, et Filii, Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Brethren, Christ is risen.
Risen indeed.
This is Timothy Flanders at the Meaning of Catholic. Welcome to another edition of the Terror of Demons Morning Show, Reclaiming Traditional Catholic Masculinity, joined as always by co-host Kennedy Hall. How you doing, brother?
I'm living the dream. How about you?
Oh, doing the same over here in the United States of America. Welcome to the second Sunday after Easter. It is, we've got St. Anselm on Wednesday. We've got Saint Soter and Caius and Saint George, great saint, on Friday, the patron of England. I'm sure there's many other countries besides England, but England, patron of England, Saint George, and Saint Fidelis of Sigmaringen. I don't know anything about him, so I'll have to look him up, tell him to my kids, because he's on the Liturgy of the Home calendar.
All right.
So, Kennedy, what has the Hall family been up to for Paschaltide?
A lot of food. we went to Mass yesterday, of course, but we're shut down again. So we'll see what that's going to mean over the next 5 weeks or so. I think there's five more weeks to slow the spread here. So we've been visiting a lot of people, although technically we're on a stay-at-home order. the whole province is, but no one's listening. It's kind of nice, different tone this time. So we were at a park yesterday. Friday they said they were going to shut down playgrounds again. But people actually lost it. And, regular people, not just the wacky conspiracy theorists like myself, regular people actually, got real upset. And then the government said, oh wait, never mind. We didn't mean it for playgrounds. And, it's a strange time to be alive. The cops are now coming out saying they won't enforce things and whatever. So it's seems to be unraveling a little bit here. I think that's kind of what has to happen. I think they've doubled down so much. So I wake up every day and I go, oh yeah, this thing's going on again. So we've been having a great time. Like, as far as, I mean, there's pretty much two societies now. You know, where I live, there's people who wear masks to parks and don't give handshakes. And then there's just other human beings. So that's where we are. So we have lots of friends and lots of people think like us, and our kids have had a blast. And so we were in a park yesterday having a picnic and eating KFC and playing on swings, and it was awesome. So
excellent. Well, that's great. Most importantly, that the kids can have a good time. My 2-year-old keeps saying, "Daddy, is it still Easter?"
And yes,
I say, "Yes, Christ is risen. Here's some candy."
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, yes. So it's been good. I've been trying to teach my 5-year-old in particular the Christ is risen chant.
Oh,
so we're getting into that. They know the Regina Caeli is pretty easy to learn because that melody is pretty easy. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to get used to remembering that. But the Greek tradition of chanting the Christos and Esti is a great tradition that I've definitely kept a few of the traditions since I was Eastern Orthodox. And it's one of my favorites is the chanting of the Christos and Esti. It would always be at our Arab church. We would just shout Christos and Esti in multiple languages after every liturgy during Paschaltide.
And it's, really?
Yeah. And we'd sing it back and forth, English and Greek. Yeah, that's normal. You typically greet each other with Christ is risen instead of hello during the whole Paschaltide. Just Christ is risen, you know, instead of hello. So definitely needs to be brought back in that area. So, all right. So we're getting back into our Fatima series. And so we want to do a little quick recap before we dive back in. So here's the chronology that we did. So we the main thing that we tried to emphasize. Let me see if I can make this better for viewers. How's that? Okay. So we tried to emphasize there's such a huge social, economic, political context for the Fatima apparitions to come about. And one of the main aspects of this series that we want to do is to try to do a true dialogue, the logos, which is where I'm going to try to disagree with what Kennedy's going to try to present here about Fatima. But we haven't really gotten into anything controversial really yet. We've just sort of presented the apparitions, which are not really controversial. Nobody, even the, even the liberals are sort of forced to, I think it was, who was it? Sperato, whoever came up with the, when they released the actual secret in 2000, or they released the part of the third secret, allegedly, I think it was, oh, it was Sodano, I think.
Yeah.
Anyways, so like the liberals, even at the Vatican, sort of have to give lip service to Vatican. Nobody really, to my knowledge, really disputes that Vatican, or that the Fatima apparitions actually happened and, you know, they exist and all this. So, quick recap. So Fatima happens at an epochal moment in the history of Western civilization in World War One. World War One is the war that changed everything. Literally everything, just everything about the modern world was really created out of World War One. And there was a bunch of social breakdown that had been happening since. In my book, I trace it back to really the suppression of the Jesuits is the big turning point. 1773. And then you have the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Haitian Revolution, the Irish Revolution, all before 1800. Yep. All these bloody revolutions exploding everywhere based on this new ideology. But still, even by 1900, you still have a lot of cultural cohesion is still existent, even by World War One.
You know what's interesting? As you mentioned, the suppression of the Jesuits, it's back to Russia again. Where did the Jesuits go? I mean, most of them just joined other orders or started other societies that were basically the Jesuits with a different name. But a lot of them went to Russia. And Catherine the Great? Was that her name?
Yes.
She accepted the Jesuits in Russia. It's, yeah. When you really look at the historical context of this Fatima apparition, which again, we should look at it. It's called Our Lady of the Rosary was what she called herself. So Our Lady of Fatima, obviously it's all Our Lady, but she made it very clear that Our Lady of the Rosary was her title. So you think about the context of that going back to Lepanto, which really is a clash of civilizations, which, yeah, anyway, East versus West and so forth. And then you have Russia being the place where the Jesuits find refuge. And then we have Fatima coming after all these revolutions happen, as you said, right after the Jesuits are suppressed. And then today we find ourselves in a situation where I was just reading Russia is basically positioning itself internationally right now in a very interesting way. Russia is such a unique country. on the one hand, you look at them, you go, wow, you're awesome. On the other hand, you look at them and you go, wow, you're insane. there's both aspects there on full force to Russia right now. And we have ourselves a Pope who is a Jesuit. Anyway, it's just a lot of heavenly symmetry. Let's put it that way.
Heavenly symmetry. That's a great way to put it. So also stay tuned this week on our Christ Against the Occult series. We will talk further detail about the suppression of the Jesuits because there's some really interesting things that happened with Russia. Russia is at that time was going through somewhat of a westernization, which was a good thing in some senses. But we talked about how the biggest aspects of this are the economic aspects during the 19th century, which is where the family defined for centuries as mother, father, children, uncles, aunts, grandpa. Yes. Nieces, cousins, all living together in a community, helping each other. So it's easy it's somewhat easy. The phrase "the village," it takes a village to raise a child is actually happening for centuries, mm-hmm. because it's easy to raise your children in an environment where grandpa's there, grandma's there, aunts or uncles are right there. This is all happening together. You have economy is the law of the home.
Yeah.
Man and woman are working together on the family farm or on the family craft or whatever. They're all working together. Everybody's got a role. You know, there's always been a contest between man and woman, but it's different economically. So then in the 19th century, everything changes. The man is outside the home. He's got to go work at the factory. He gets money away from his family. He's getting into alcohol and prostitutes. The woman is at home. She doesn't have the same economic life, or she gets forced into the factory as well as the children. Yeah. And then you have the creation of the teenager. Before this, there was no teenagers, didn't exist. These youths are idle, or they're in factories. They're just separate. The family's broken down by the economy, by this economic situation. And then they're moved far away from the parish. And so the church is trying to keep up with all of the migration to the cities and all of the, and then especially by 1900 and 19 into World War One, there are these, what I call re-education camps, which is basically public education. All these states are putting them in these education camps to educate them to worship the nation. So in World War One, you have millions of baptized Christians killing millions of baptized Christians for the sake of the economic interests of the elites. That's what World War One is.
Yeah.
But I don't know if we mentioned this, but in World War One, in 1914, you have these various truces for Christmas.
Yeah.
These spontaneous truces where you have Germans, French, and English. They say, hey, it's Christmas. We should just stop fighting and party together.
Yeah.
So they stop fighting and they party together. They get together and they start having these Christmas feasts. And that's because they still have this Christian culture, even though they're very secularized. They haven't been to church. You know, they don't even have a church or whatever. But they still have this instinct that they have to stop for Christmas. And
there's a good movie called Joyeux Noël.
Yes.
It's actually pretty good. And they make the church look okay in it, actually, which is rare for a movie. And
I thought that movie was really good. Yes.
It's good. It's a good movie. And I used to use it when I was teaching because it was in French and English. So it was like a bilingual thing. But yeah.
Right. So but during the war, they're using psychological warfare, which is the term used by Edward Bernays in the United States
Freud's cousin.
Yes, Freud's cousin, or Freud's nephew, actually. Nephew. So they're using psychological warfare. The Germans are using it. The English are using it. The Americans are using it. Everybody's using it to try to manipulate your emotions to basically worship the nation and hate the enemy as a subhuman, kill them. So Ed Bernays pioneers the idea of the term psychological warfare for his own people, because the American Empire's got to manipulate all these German Americans, who at that time were very influential, to support a war with Germany. And so they do it in America. Yeah. It's very successful. All of this is happening and breaking down society. Now, the big conspiracies are the Masonic conspiracy on the one hand and the Marxist conspiracy on the other hand. And all of these are just puppets for the demons, who are the real conspiracy, because they're not all talking to each other and making a big plan. They're basically just sort of moving around as puppets trying to achieve the same end, which is the destruction of the family, destruction of Christendom. And as we'll see today, the destruction of family life in the first sexual revolution.
Yeah. Where I live, there's a city called Kitchener, 40 minutes away. It was called Berlin until the First World War.
That's funny.
All around here, it's
a lot of Germans.
The Pennsylvania Dutch. So we have really unique farmland about 40 minutes away. So during some upheaval in the U.S., tons of Mennonites and Amish came up to Canada. And so we have the Pennsylvania Dutch up here. They brought with them all their German names, etc. So all around me are all these places called German city names, German town names, except Kitchener is now called, Berlin was now called Kitchener, and Lord Kitchener was a British figure. Because people revolted basically at the name of a German town during the First World War. Can you continue for 2 seconds? I've got to run and just check something real quick.
Yeah, sure. No problem. Yeah. Kids happen, everybody. So let me review a little bit of the apparitions that we had here. Let's see if I can put this up here again. Add to stream. There we go. Okay. So we talked about how Our Lady has a common theme when she's addressing these liberal revolutions, which are essentially trying to build the city of man without God's help. It's just a new Tower of Babel, is what Dietrich von Hildebrand said in a book in 1953. The new Tower of Babel. Man is trying to build a new society that's different than what was before. Now, this is different than Protestantism. Protestantism is just making a new religion, or just truncating Catholicism into various elements of Catholicism, like the Holy Scriptures and baptism. But it's not really trying to create a brand new society per se. They still have a Christian society in theory. Even the Anglican society that's heretical has various religious revivals over the years. You have the Methodist revival in the late 18th century, various Great Awakenings. So you still have a strongly Christian society even among the Protestants. But with these liberal revolutions, and when I say liberal, we're talking about classical liberalism. The term classical liberalism basically means a republican system that is a revolt, particularly the American and French revolutions. But even going back to the Dutch Revolution, 1585, the Battle of Empel, Our Lady reveals the Immaculate Conception as the patroness of the army of Flanders. Same thing happens with Christopher Columbus a few generations before that. The Santa Maria, the Saint Mary of the Immaculate Conception is the flagship with lands of the Americas. And then you have the Immaculate Conception against the American Empire in 1793. Bishop John Carroll dedicates the United States to the Immaculate Conception. And then in the 19th century, especially, what we reviewed was we have Saint Catherine Le Bourget with the Miraculous Medal, which is the Immaculate Conception. Then you have the Our Lady of La Salette, which is making reference to, in that apparition, it makes reference to the Industrial Revolution, which is forcing people to work on Sundays. And people are stopping they're not observing the third commandment. They're working on Sundays. And then you have Our Lady of Lourdes, which is also the Immaculate Conception. And at the same time, Blessed Pius IX is dogmatizing the Immaculate Conception. Now, why is the Immaculate Conception so important? It's because people are trying to build the city of man without God. And so they are denying original sin. They're denying that one needs the divine grace to overcome original sin. One can simply build the city of man without God. So you can deny original sin. That's why the Immaculate Conception is so important. And Pius IX actually said the Immaculate Conception will rebuke those who exalt human reason above its limits. It will rebuke them because it says that only the Immaculate Mother was originally conceived without original sin. Everyone else has original sin. That's what Immaculate Conception is. It's a dogma about original sin, that only Our Lady was, you know, because basically liberalism is saying we don't really have original sin, or it's either non-existent or not really that bad. Well,
And when did Our Lady, the Immaculate Conception apparition happened was right around, it was basically historically on the eve of the publication of Darwin's book.
There we go.
And
if
you go, I mean, Mike's, I think probably, I don't know if he's talked about it yet, but I mean, if you look at all those things, Rousseau, Darwin, and Malthus, and all these Marx and Robespierre and all these major Voltaire, all these thinkers, they're all, as you always say, guided by the same fallen angels. So their philosophies sound very similar. And it's just ultimately sort of pantheism. It's ultimately Rousseau, you know, is ultimately the culmination of those ideas put into some sort of palatable philosophical formula. And evolution is a key in that, because it's this idea that We're moving towards a place of progress, and we're getting better and better and better, moving away from our distant past. And original sin does not fit in that plan. And that's one of the reasons why the evolutionary error is so detrimental to the faith, besides scientific grounds, but just on the basic anthropology of man.
Yeah, so it really, so much of it goes back to just original sin. It's basically a new Pelagianism. It's saying we can just use science, and that the problem with human nature is not original sin. The problem with human nature is just, oh, we got bad economics. Let's just change the economic policy and we'll be all set. Mm-hmm. Or we got bad politics. Okay, let's just change the politics. We'll be all set. Or not enough people are voting. Let's just make more people vote and then we'll be all set. So that's what's identified as the problem. It's not original sin. It's just we have the bad economic system. This is the brave new world. It'll be so great when we just create this republic and everybody can vote. It'll be perfect.
And if everybody just wears a mask, like no one will ever get sick again. It's the same thing.
Perfect. Yep. Yep. So, and you know, we didn't actually mention also the important aspect of the Habsburgs and the loss of monarchy.
Yeah.
That is an essential aspect, because essentially since the suppression of the Jesuits, there's been a revolt against fatherhood itself. So revolt against the Jesuits is a revolt against fatherhood, because these are the priests. The Jesuits are all fathers who educated all of society. You know, they run all these educations, institutions. All of the people in society are, I mean, not all of them, but many of them are educated by the Jesuits. You've all the government officials, people, lawyers, everybody. And then you suppress the fathers, the fatherhood. And then you have this revolt against monarchy in the American and French revolutions. And the monarch is simply the father of the nation.
You know, the Jesuits are so important. I just want to go my Jesuit soapbox here for a second.
Yes, please.
I know that obviously the Jesuits today have major issues, but when the Jesuits are, when they're done right, they are like an unbelievable order of priests.
The army of Jesus.
They're unbelievable. And you know, it's just, I was talking to the other day, Father Couture, who is a wonderful priest. He has various videos up for the Fatima Center, especially about the Shroud of Turin. It's kind of a hobby pet project of his. So he does these wonderful talks on the Shroud of Turin. And anyway, he was the former district superior for Canada for the Society of St. Pius X. And something came up the other day, and I was reading through, when I was visiting him last October, he was telling me about how Marcel Lefebvre was providentially trained by X, Y, and Z. And when he was a bishop, he was in this position where he had seen all the major orders under his care, because he was a bishop of Africa. So all these great missionary orders. And out of all those things, the basis for the spirituality of the Society of St. Pius X is Ignatian spiritual exercises. That's the baseline spirituality for all priests and all people who are in the third order, which actually means it's the baseline for the fraternity in all these places, because they're all, you know, spiritual sons of the same lineage. And I said, you know what's crazy about this, Father? I said, there's something about, you know, we live in the age where we're seeing all those errors of that Protestant revolution really come to fruition. And that's where Ignatius, you know, that's why the providence of the Jesuits coming out was to fight that advent of Protestantism and so forth, similar timing. And they did such an amazing job of that, spreading throughout the world, and the true missionary spirit, true education, spirit of education and so forth, doing it so properly, going to all four corners of the globe. And I said, it's almost like the true Ignatian, it's almost like the church started to decline when the church rejected that spirit of Ignatius, if that makes sense, the true Ignatian spirit. And I said, it's so amazing that the traditional orders are preserving the flame of the Ignatian spirituality. And that seems to be the remedy against modernism. And he said, that's exactly what we think. And that's what Marcel Lefebvre thought, which is why he made the Ignatian spirituality the basis for the society. So even though some people clamor on, oh, the Jesuits should be disbanded and stuff. Well, I mean, obviously heretics should be suppressed and that's fine, but it's kind of like the corruption of the best is the worst. You know, you think of the most annoying people on earth right now in the church, and it's men like Father James Martin. But they show just how far the mighty have fallen, because a man like Father Martin, okay, if I can be charitable as possible to him here, he's obviously very smart. He's obviously very articulate. I mean, you can't sell books on Catholicism to people who don't believe in Catholicism at the rate that he does if you weren't a good writer. There's something where we should pray every day for the reform or the reinvigoration of the Jesuits, because it's almost as, in a sense of the institutional side of the church, it's almost like as goes the denigration of the spirit of Ignatius, so goes the church. But on the corollary, it seems very providentially in line right now, where a reform and a reinvigorated Jesuit order would actually, in some sense, kind of save the church. So anyway, I think there's something really important there.
Yeah.
And also, we see culminated with Francis and this strange pontificate, himself being a Jesuit. It's all very strange.
Yeah, I think what the Jesuits do is that they incarnate in a new way the crusading spirit, which has always animated the church since the days of the martyrs in the early church.
That's right.
Which is a crusading spirit, which is against the fallen angels directly. It's not trying to kill flesh and blood like humans. It's like that when we talk about the conspiracy, we're talking about these are puppets of the demons. So we're trying to convert them and baptize them. They're not our enemies per se. The real enemies are the angels, the fallen angels. And so the Jesuits incarnate that same crusading spirit in a new way, which is sort of for the modern world, because they are exquisitely intellectual. They are at the cutting edge of the intellectual culture. And they always have been. They've always been the leaders in every field of science, philosophy, everything.
Yep.
And so they're at the cutting edge, really leading all the intellectuals.
Yeah.
And they're leading them to Christ.
Well, put it this way. Yep. The Jesuits, like, the formation is really long and arduous traditionally, if it's done well.
I think it's like 11 years or something. It's a long time. That's maybe one of the longest I've ever heard of in terms of religious orders.
And they're really smart. Like, just objectively speaking, the academic necessities or prerequisites to be a Jesuit are really strong. And we never more than ever in history, probably, with the advent of information technology, do we live in an age of more war of information. You know, that's Alex Jones saying info wars. But like, that's true. This is an info war. Propaganda is an info war, education is an info war, etc. So they were providentially set up to fight the spread of misinformation by inculcating the truth. Because one thing I always come back to, people will say, well, how does everyone believe in this thing that's going on right now? How does everyone believe in evolution? It's mortal sin. You know, like when your intellect is darkened, you believe stupid things, because your soul, technically speaking, is a dead soul, and your intellect is a spiritual property. It's a metaphysical property. So your hardware might be fine. You know, like, you know, you see all these people that are, they have their PhDs and they can write a 600 page piece of dribble about something technologically peer reviewed, something, something, something. And you go, how did you even do that? Because you can't even balance a checkbook. You can't even, like, you know, or whatever. We see all the problems today with so-called science. These people are smart, intelligent in a technical sense, but they live with dead souls, so their intellects are severely darkened. The Jesuits and their educational zeal, and then combined with obviously the sacraments and the sanctifying grace and the enlightenment of the intellect, is the perfect remedy for that. So again, we need to pray that they come back.
Yeah. So in World War One, we have the corrupting of the Jesuits is happening right at this moment. You have George Tyrrell, mm-hmm. is the proto. There's Alfred Loisy and George Tyrrell are the big names in the first modernist crisis under Pius X. Mm-hmm. And George Tyrrell is a Jesuit, who is the first real, to my knowledge, the first real prominent, influential Jesuit who openly disobeys the Pope and dies a heretic. And the Jesuits take a fourth vow, and the fourth vow is strict obedience to the Pope directly.
Yeah.
And so he breaks his vows as a Jesuit, dies a heretic, and another Jesuit named Teilhard de Chardin is intimately tied in with that very moment when he's actually in formation. Teilhard de Chardin is in formation and becoming a Jesuit as Tyrol is waging a war with the Pope. And Teilhard de Chardin is in World War One. And he says about World War One, where millions of civilians are dying, he has this bizarre spiritual experience where he says this is the birth of something new, and he's on the front lines. He's a stretcher bearer, so he's on the front lines. He's seeing all these fathers of families being killed. He's seeing before his eyes widows being created. He's seeing before his eyes orphans being created, and he says, we're at the dawn of a new era. This is creating a new birth of humanity. So he somehow has this bizarre evolutionary idea, because his evolutionary idea is that evil itself is sort of a byproduct of evolution becoming greater. So when you believe in evolution strictly, even in like the very spiritual sense that he does, he believes that evil itself is part of just a natural process of growth, because that's what, you know, the survival of the fittest is. It's basically just evil and corruption sort of birthing something better. So it's easy to think of World War One in that sense. When you have a Teilhard de Chardin viewpoint, you can look at World War One and not think that it's a punishment from God and repent of your sin. You can think of it, well, this is a birth of a new thing. That's great. Well, George, and
yeah.
Well, let me just say this.
So George Tyrell, when you said his name, it made me peek and I said, oh, I've seen him before. And like, but you know, he's a huge part of the evolutionary heresy.
I didn't know he was I know he's evolution of dogma. I didn't know he was into like the science.
Darwin was a big thing for him. Everyone should go check out the series Foundations Restored by the Kolbe Center. And they do a really, for the first two or three episodes, they do an incredible history. Basically, it's a history of modernism. But it shows how evolution is at the heart of the whole thing. And they do a really creepy job of showing Teilhard de Chardin and going through his writings. It's pretty clear that the man might have been like perfectly possessed. When you actually read how he speaks about, he calls it the thing, right? And that he encounters, even as a young man, he has these weird spiritual experiences. And same with Descartes, he had a similar thing. It seems like he was pretty much demonically oppressed or possessed ultimately. But when you read Teilhard de Chardin, and his writings sound very much like Hinduism. When you really look into it, sounds like if you've ever read a dialogue of the so-called gods, and it's like, you know, I am to those who are dead, I am death, and to those who are alive, I am the spirit of truth, like this random kind of stuff. I remember reading some little booklet once I found about Hinduism. And it was like dialogues between these demons or something. And and when you read de Chardin, when the God thing that presents himself to him, and he talks about how, like, I am all things to all men. I am the prince of the demons. I am the king of the angels. Like, it's very, very weird. And that's Chardin's spiritual background. And him and Tyrell are at the heart of the corruption of the greatest order, basically.
Yeah, so just looked up. Teilhard de Chardin has what he calls nostalgia for the front, meaning the front lines of the battle where all this bloodshed's happening. And he calls it, quote, a plenitude of being and of something more than human, carrying the world of man towards its new destiny.
It's so creepy.
That was a quote from the letters that he wrote in the 23rd and 25th of 1917, which is published in The Making of a Mind, Letters of a Soldier Priest, 1965. So the destruction of monarchy. So what we have after the American Empire enters the war is we have two gospels. You have the gospel of the American Empire, which is freedom. Freedom will, once again, is another denial of original sin. All we need is just economic freedom or political freedom and everything will be great. Mm-hmm. And this is the propaganda of Woodrow Wilson, is this is going to be a new birth of freedom, new birth of democracy. That's what we're fighting for. We're fighting against the evil German emperor, and we're going to destroy all monarchies. And this is something that helps the American Empire helps bring about. So Blessed Charles of Austria, the Holy Roman Emperor, in not even not in title, but it de facto for Holy Roman Emperor, he's acting as the Holy Roman Emperor during the war. He's brokering peace. He's trying to end these hostilities for these what Benedict the 15th said purely economic reasons. And he gets forced off the throne. And this is what this destruction of monarchy is what helps bring about the situation, which is ripe for sexual revolution and its reaction in Hitler and Stalin. So this is this the end of this war is what's really creating the situation of the next war. And really, some historians say that World War One and Two are just kind of one war with a 20-year truce in between them.
Yeah,
because the same issues, basically the issues before World War One, are exacerbated by the end, which then creates the situation for the next. So, we talked about the apparitions, which, and we haven't even gotten to the sexual revolution we're trying to get to here, but so we talked about the apparitions, which are boiling down the apparitions, if we can possibly. You can go watch the whole walkthrough that we did. But is essentially saying that the problem is not that we need to build a new city and a new economic political system. The problem is original sin. The problem is human sin. Mm-hmm. Man is offending God. That's the problem. So we need to repent. That's the problem and solution of Fatima. We need to repent. And Our Lady asks pious souls to suffer and do penance for the sake of sinners. And specifically, she gives the first, the Blessed Sacrament, the devotions to the Blessed Sacrament, and she gives the devotions of the daily rosary and are the five first Saturdays given in these first revelations? I'm not sure if they are.
July, I think.
July. Okay, so she does say first Saturday. So we're given these these devotions to make penance. So before we wrap up
I'll add though quickly.
Go ahead.
Inherent in the Fatima theology, though, I just was writing an article actually for the Next Crusader magazine, is the doctrine of mediatrix of all graces and also co-redemptrix, which is under attack today. Because if you read the prayer that the angel taught, it talks about the infinite mercies from the Immaculate Heart, which actually was sort of a teaching that was being put forth by the popes. It was in tradition, obviously, but it was being cemented by Pius X and Benedict XV, talking about Mary's role as reparatrix or redemptrix, whatever term you end up using, where she had a unique and singular role that was, in a sense of God's holy will, obviously not necessary in a sufficient cause for redemption, because Christ paid the price fully and so on and so forth. But because she's a new Eve, there was a singular role that Eve played with the old Adam, and there was a singular role that the new Eve played with the new Adam. So it's another one of those things where when we deny an aspect of Mariology, we end up denying Christology. You know, if we have a bad Mariology, we have a bad Christology. That's always been the case. That's why Nestorianism was so pernicious and so forth. And the same thing is with Redemptrix. So inherent in the Fatima, especially in the July apparition, is very meaty theologically when you look into it. And when she says only she can save you, that was something that really confounded people, because you're like, no, only Christ can save you, you know, or ultimately it's only Christ. And it was the way that God has willed things to happen is that her being the mediatrix of all graces, which is just the miraculous metal apparition and so forth, which she appears like the miraculous metal at Fatima, with the light from heaven coming out of her hands and so forth. That doctrine is actually cemented there. So we're in a sense kind of seeing the fulfillment of like the anti-Fatima 100-year period after the 1929 right now, with now even from Holy Father, unfortunately, saying very plainly, oh, Mary is not the redemptrix of the co-redemptrix. And it's like, oh, that's kind of against all the tradition and all the popes and whatever. So that's there's a lot in there. Again, Fatima being a true apparition, a culmination of, it's almost like the insurance policy on the last 600 years of apparitions, everything that they were trying to say. And Mary's role is unique, not just in the redemption of the world through consecration of Russia, which would bring her an era of peace, but also in the church by having proper Mariology, which keeps our Christology. So they're both intrinsically linked.
Yes, absolutely. So she also mentions the spread of Russia's errors. And we talked about how Russia was being consecrated to the Immaculate Heart at that very moment by the Synod of Petrograd. And the Catholic Russian Catholics were forming at that time and consecrating the Russian people to Mary to convert her. And the conversion of Russia was already spoken of by missionaries at that time. They wanted the conversion of Russia, which meant that they would become Catholic.
Yeah.
And the Bolshevik Revolution was then happening in the fall of 1917. Mm-hmm. And Lenin and Trotsky are taking over. Mm-hmm. And so by Martinmas 1918 is when the armistice is signed. Now, before we talk about the political and social economic aspects of the end of World War One, Kennedy, what happens after immediately following the Fatima apparitions? Because they're not, I don't know, when are they approved? What can you take us to the end, sort of wrap up the Fatima apparition period? What happens after that as the war ends?
Well, immediately after, I mean, it's a local, it stays as a, it made some news obviously throughout the world. But it stayed as a localized thing for, when was it approved? It was either in the 1930s or the 1950s. I don't know why. I can't remember.
So we have 70,000 Portuguese, mostly Portuguese. Yeah. So mostly Portuguese are the ones who've seen it. Eugenia Pacelli apparently did see these see the miracle of the sun. He is said to have witnessed it, Friedrich Pius XII.
Yeah, sorry, 1930. Jose Correa of Lara approves the Fatima apparitions. And that's actually, people don't realize, or maybe they do, but the local bishop, I've heard this from, well, priests like Father Ripperger and so forth, that the local bishop actually has a charism in his office of being able to approve apparitions without error. Hence why the Medjugorje ones are so controversial, because the two or three bishops of there never approve them, and basically declared, no, this is not a good thing. Another apparition, though, was Our Lady of Zaytun, which was in Egypt, and the Catholic hierarchy actually said, we will defer to the judgment of the Orthodox bishop, which that's a very interesting thing, because that whole, how do you look at that? But anyway, so...
Was that the same time as this?
That's in the 60s.
Oh, later? Okay.
So, but also, so basically, this period is a massive period of revolution, okay, at the same time happening in Mexico.
Early 1920s. I forgot about that as well.
Which, what's at the heart of the resistance to the Mexican Revolution is Our Lady of Guadalupe, who, bring it back to Our Lady of the Rosary, Our Lady of Guadalupe is actually from Spain originally. And so that's why they knew the name of Our Lady. We talked about this around then in the December episode of the show. And Our Lady of Guadalupe, the Mexican one, was given to Don John of Austria. And on one of the main ship at the front of their fleet, that the Battle of Lepanto, there was a replica of Our Lady of Guadalupe's image that was used to defeat the Eastern Turks, you know, the invasion there. Under the banner of Our Lady of Guadalupe, but under the patronage of Our Lady of the Rosary. So we see Our Lady of the Rosary coming back here in full force at a place called Fatima, which is the name of Muhammad's favorite daughter. Again, we see this clash of civilizations between the Muhammadan Turks and the Catholics. And it's all just comes back around. So we end up seeing the same fallen angel behind all of these things, even though if you call them different names. And what's needs to be remembered too is Our Lady said Russia's errors would spread. Now, actually, Fatimists will tell you that the errors of Russia are actually from the West, because the errors of Russia were basically imported through academia and so forth into France, or from France into Russia, which is a great book to read about. That would be our brothers Karamazov. Basically, the French revolutionary spirit had made its way into Russia through academia and so forth, through cultural exchange and whatever, which is why Russia has rugby, little piece of trivia. So that's all coming to fruition there. And Our Lady, this is the thing people need to understand. Our Lady said the heirs of Russia. She didn't say the heirs of Italy. She didn't say the heirs of Germany. She didn't say the heirs of Japan. We have a trick of the devil is that we lionize certain villains from World War II, which I know it's very controversial. When you look into the history of World War II, you realize it's really hard to say who's a good guy and a bad guy. Obviously, Hitler had his wacky idiosyncrasies, and the concentration camps were an evil thing. No one's denying that. But you look back and you go, so the West sided with Stalin and other guys sided with Hitler. So you pick two really bad devils, and some of us are good guys because we picked the other devil. I don't really understand.
Yeah, they were originally on the same side as well in the beginning of the war. So yeah, that's a whole we'll get to that as well.
But that's part of Fatima. That's part of Fatima, like, because the heirs of Russia is everything.
And you know everything. What? I found something out during my when I was writing my book, and that the year 1900, Our Lady was raising up the throne. What I say is that the Mary herself and the Immaculate Conception in particular is the throne of Christ on earth, because mm-hmm. Mary incarnates Jesus Christ as the King on earth.
Remonstrance.
And so So she's the temple of God. She's the throne of Christ. She's the one who makes present the throne of Christ. And what's really fascinating is that in the providence of God, he was actually raising two massive cathedrals to the Immaculate Conception in Asia, mm-hmm. one in Moscow mm-hmm. in 1900, mm-hmm. and the other in Nagasaki, Japan, mm-hmm. 1900. Okay. So both these huge churches are being raised. They're the biggest churches in Asia at this time. Yeah. And they're being raised in 1900. So they're surrounding the two evil empires that are going to be coming out of Asia, the Soviets and the Chinese. The
Immaculate Heart.
With the Immaculate Conception. So, but then the other evil empire will destroy one of those cathedrals. Stay tuned for that.
Nagas, the Catholic, there's a real, well, actually, Trad Patrick talks about this, but his research is always very unique. And there's a real, good reason to believe that Nagasaki and Hiroshima were actually picked because of anti-Catholic prejudice, mainly because they weren't the most strategic. They weren't the most politically strategic cities from a sense of population or anything, because they're just sort of medium Japanese cities. But that's where all the Catholics were.
Well, yes, we will. We will definitely get into that. So, end of World War One.
Yep.
One of the things that happens is that God punishes the world with plague, the Spanish flu. Mm-hmm. Spanish flu hits the world around the end of the Great War, because men are not repenting. What happens at the end of the Great War is that there is a Martinmas armistice is signed, November 11, 1918. Yeah. And what happens immediately is that the victorious parties attempt to punish the losers of the war.
Germans.
And it's even debatable whether or not they even lost the war.
Of course.
But Benedict the 15th had always been advocating since the very beginning, no war revenge, mm-hmm. no war revenge, because they just want to take revenge on each other. And to his credit, Woodrow Wilson was actually advocating something a little bit more mitigated than the war revenge that took place. So to his credit, but he was still advocating against Benedict the 15th's.
Yeah.
Just basically put all of the borders back the way they were before. No war revenge, just reconcile, just which would be the only just solution to this war, because it was a totally economic war. Nobody was everyone was at fault for this war. Everybody. Every side was at fault. Mm-hmm. The Germans were at fault. The British were at fault. The Americans just came out of nowhere and sided with one party over another for no reason other than their economic reasons. And so there was no justice in this war. It was not a just war of any kind. It was just a war for economic reasons. So that's what Benedict XV said. We need to just acknowledge this was just all parties were at fault. Let's all reconcile. But the counter gospel is what wins. The American gospel of freedom, which is where we need to destroy all monarchies, we need to destroy all non-republican governments, and we need to impose economic freedom. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be what is the destructive factor in one of the destructive factors in the first sexual revolution, which we're not even going to get into that. We're just going to set this whole thing up. But God punishes the world with the Spanish flu.
Yeah.
So it's a real plague. People are dying. all over the world. It's causing a crisis. And this is God's salutary judgment at the end of World War One. Because what happens is the armistice, the Peace of Paris, is they set it up on January 18, which is actually hearkening back to when the Germans took Paris in 1871. So the French are not only going to take revenge against the Germans for, at that time it was the Prussians, but they're taking revenge all the way from two generations ago. They're still hating each other. They're trying to take revenge. So that what they do is they put this blockade against the German families, and they don't allow any food and water. We have hundreds of thousands of German men, women, and children starve to death or die of disease because the Allies after World War One blockade them. Now the Germans are not innocent, of course. They did their own problems as well. But at this time, because of this war revenge, they take revenge. And they forced the Germans to sign the Treaty of Versailles, which is a disaster for the German economy. It's a total disaster. They have to pay millions of dollars as war reparations, which is just war revenge, for no apparent reason. Nobody's at fault here. The Germans are just the losers, so they get punished. Their economy is destroyed, and because of the destruction of monarchy, the destruction of at that time it was an empire. Advocated by the American Empire, we have the seedbed is made for the first sexual revolution and the reactions of Hitler. And at this time, there's the sexual revolution is getting going in the Soviet Union, which we'll get into.
Sexual libertinism is always necessary for revolution. And although I vehemently disagree with E. Michael Jones on Fatima and the Society of St. Pius X, his unique historical outlook on libido dominandi and the sort of way that sexual tools have been used to cause revolution and unrest amongst people is remarkable. And little anecdotal stories from what happened. So Paris had it rough during World War One and World War Two, and they were occupied both times, basically. And soldiers were in both times. I can't remember if Paris was occupied during World War One, but the point is, there's stories basically from the prostitutes of France. Okay. And they experienced no uptick in business during World War One, even though the city was filled with soldiers. They experienced an immense uptick in business during World War Two, when the city was filled with soldiers. So you got to think about that for a second. The greatest generation, so-called, it's not really the greatest generation. Obviously, from a perspective of human steam and like ingenuity and work ethic and all that sort of thing, from the being in the cog and the capitalist machine, they really did build our society and they did have many estimable virtues. I'm not going to deny that. But the moral decay had already happened, and it happened strongly after the First World War, which you see with the Roaring Twenties and then culminating in the Dirty Thirties and so forth. We're kind of going into a period like that right now. We're in the 20s right now, and we see moral decay amongst, from a sexually libertine perspective, although more absurd nowadays, it really is accelerating. It really is accelerating at this point. And we also see our world going through a sort of, let's call it, massive economic shift from various reasons, obviously. People talking about resets and so forth, because we've gone through some such great calamity that the world needs to be rethought in a new way, which sounds exactly like what was happening after the First World War. You know, the war to end all wars had happened, and we all had to move into a place of united, the League of Nations with basically became the United Nations and human fraternity and all this kind of things. And we're just going through something like that right now. History sure does rhyme, as Mark Twain said. But the sexual ethics were actually still quite strong at that time during the First World War, as much as there were problems, even in places that were not Catholic. Like, it was just the steam of virtue was still around, and the residual Christian virtue. But fast forward right after this, and you see a generation completely corrupted to the point when you send your soldiers 20 years later, they're no longer staying chase when they go to war. They have a devil may care attitude, and they're using prostitutes at an alarming rate. And that's the greatest generation. I mean, that's the sad, people call them that, but that's true.
Yep. And that, so we're going to see how the first sexual revolution, which is set up by the First World War,
yep,
in the 1920s, is what really breaks down society. And you have the reaction of that in fascism, especially, is that fascism is a reaction of basically World War One veterans. All of these men are, yes, World War One veterans who are reacting against a cultural breakdown that's going to happen in the 1920s in just a few minutes. Now, the Spanish flu, I actually looked it up. It actually began February 1918. So God is actually punishing the world, mm-hmm, during World War One at this point. So we had Fatima. No one's repenting. God punishes the world with salutary plague. That was, so 500 million people died. And this Wikipedia says that was about a third of the world's population at that time. One third. That's huge. This is talking Black Death. Approaching Black Death is, I mean, the Black
Death. It was young people.
Right. So the Spanish flu hits during the end of World War One. Finally, there's a something of a repentance because they finally stopped fighting. Mm-hmm. And but I was Sears die of Spanish flu? Francisco and Jacinta?
I don't know if it was Spanish flu. I should know that, but they died.
So they died 1919 and 1920.
Yeah.
So you have the two saintly Sears.
Yeah.
Who die at that time. We'll have to look that up. Somebody in the chat, if you know, was it the Spanish flu or not? What else sets up the, I think one of the biggest things, we'll talk about the economics as well. So you have the economic breakdown, and we're going to talk about jazz music and why that became sexualized and why that's really a corruption of a Catholic culture in New Orleans. So we'll talk about that next week when we get further into the sexual revolution of the 1920s. But I think one of the biggest things is that the governments learned how to manipulate their population. Mm-hmm. Because in the beginning, you had those Christmas truces in 1914, but after that, they stopped doing those.
Well, they got really mad. They were really chastised for that.
Yeah, we're going to get rid of Christmas. What the Great War is all about is about getting rid of Christmas. That's what it is. Getting rid of peace on earth, goodwill to men.
I know we're about
destroying the custom of Christmas.
Like, I know we're going to get into this, and you're going to give the best defense of the consecration and so forth, but people, read your history. And like Mark Twain was right. It doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. You look at the fundamental desires of the Marxists. Look at the goals of the Marxist manifesto, Communist manifesto, and then look at what you're living through right now and see if you can tick off any of the same boxes. We all of the same errors are more pernicious than they ever were. I mean, you know who's, remember that stupid, that rapper Pitbull? And it doesn't matter.
no, I don't.
There's this video that's going viral. Okay, this is hilarious. There's a video that's going viral. So his family's Cuban. So they left communist Cuba.
Yeah.
Been to Cuba 3 times. Beautiful country, but it's communist. And so there's this, I mean, anyway, out of this, God spoke through an ass in the Old Testament. So sometimes the information comes through the most interesting places. And Pitbull, there's a video of him. Oh, Spanish flu. Okay. There's a video of him talking to his fellow, I don't know who they were, but they're drinking and smoking and stuff. And he's going over what's happening right now. That's right. Subsequent pulmonary problems. Thank you. Lowell's always on the ball. And, he's going through all the things happening right now. And he's talking about how it's a communist takeover. Cause he says, listen, my family grew up teaching me about what communism was. And he's like, smells like communism right now, and goes through all these things and why he sees it from his Cuban perspective, which is, we forget that, you know, we forget that Cubans are communist refugees, you know, in a sense, the ones that came over. And, and he makes a joke, and he says right now, Castro is spinning in his grave saying, you took over with a virus. He's like, why didn't I ever think of that? You know, like all the death and mayhem and battles and things we had to have, all the bullets fired. He's like, you just had to convince them they were going to get sick. But the point is, our population today is so sufficiently demoralized. So the errors of Russia are like the air that we breathe nowadays. which when we do talk about it, is I'll keep coming back to, listen, if we have had the consecration and we have had the air of peace, I'm still trying to find where it happened. And as bad as that period of time on Earth was, it was still morally superior to what we're going through right now, because we've instantiated all of those errors and we don't even fight them anymore. We just accept them and we actually fight those who oppose them. And that's ubiquitous in our culture today.
Yeah, I was just looking up, at least on Wikipedia, Spanish flu. Various scholars do argue that the Spanish flu helped end World War One.
Probably.
By tipping the balance. Older. Yeah. So there's various, it's difficult to bring about.
It's tough with virology. Like, yeah. One of the things I've learned so much this last year is there's actually people who don't believe in viruses and they're legit scientists. Not that they don't believe people get sick, but they have a different. Louis Pasteur, you know, that scientist, he had a competitor, let's say, at the time, and there's still two viable theories, and it's strange, but they're growing, and they're about the endemic nature of how you get sick. And one school does believe that you actually can't catch a virus, but instead that the symptoms are endemic and various stimuli ignite those symptoms in you. Anyway, so people have looked back at the Spanish flu, and it's a very strange thing how it passed all over the world so quickly. And one of the things they actually say might have happened, this goes to the one theory about how virus is already in you and have to be activated in a sense, was large-scale radiation on Earth, because it was the most radio technology had been used in a way that never was before, and had basically triggered an immune response in people that which is why it spread also to young people. You know, it was 20 men in their early 20s were the biggest victims of the Spanish flu, which doesn't make sense when you think about the frail nature of the elderly and sickly. So anyway, it's history of viruses. We can't even get it right now. Looking back and trying to historically decide what happened.
Yes. Dangerous. Absolutely. So we got to wrap up. And so next week we'll cover the first sexual revolution period that happens after World War One, especially in the 1920s. And this is really the point that really sets up the whole modern world is really this yep. aftermath, this first sexual revolution. And we're going to see what happens with Fatima and how Fatima is the key. And everything, I think we won't really get into controversy until World War II and Pius XII probably, but eventually I will be arguing against Kennedy, all of Kennedy's points. When we get into the controversy. So we'll get into that eventually, God willing, by your prayers. So this week, once again, we've got Christ Against the Occult this week, part, I think, 7, which we'll talk more about the suppression of the Jesuits, which we touched on today. And we also have this week, we have Baroque Music. We have a show on Baroque Music with Massimo Scapin. And so that'll premiere on Wednesday. So once again, thank you to all patrons. Please support us on Patreon. Please buy the books. Kennedy Hall has Terror of Demons linked below. Introduction to the Bible that supports the work that we do here. So thanks for watching. Let's offer up an Our Father for true penance that we need today. Let's see. I'm not... here we are. In nomine Patris, et Filii, Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Pater noster, qui es in caelis, sanctificetur nomen tuum, adveniat regnum tuum, fiat voluntas tua, sicut in caelo et in terra.
Panem notrem quotidianum da nobis hodie, et dimitte nobis debita nostra, sicut et nos dimittimus debitoribus nostris, et ne nos inducas in tentationem, sed libera nos mala. Amen.
In nomine Patris, et Filii, Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Christ is risen.
Indeed, risen indeed.